So this is the last lecture on the nervous system, lecture three. I want to talk about transferring the message between neurons. And the synapse, as we know, is the place where one neuron meets another. And it's an interesting phenomenon. You all know this, but I think maybe when you first learned it, it was maybe a surprise to you that neurons don't physically touch one another. There is a gap between them. And because there's a gap, you got to get the message across that gap. And the way we do that, or the way neurons do that, is using a special chemical called a neurotransmitter. And therefore, if we think about the nervous system, information is transferred first electrically along the surface of the neurons, and then secondly, chemically across the synapse between neurons. And this process is repeated again and again as information moves through the nervous system. Okay? That's the basic way it works. I want to take in this next slide, I want to look at the anatomy of a chemical synapse. And I want to begin by taking a look. What we have here is illustrated is an illustration of what's called the synaptic terminal, also known as the axon terminal. You'll see it in both ways. And it's simply the end of the axon, and there can be hundreds or thousands of these at the end of an axon. So don't get the impression that if you have, let's say, a neuron, it has a cell body, one long axon, and one synaptic terminal. You'll have one axon always, but then it can divide up into hundreds or thousands of axon terminals or synaptic terminals. So just be aware of that. And inside, you can see these sort of translucent bodies. And these are called the synaptic vesicles, and they're simply organelles which contain the neurotransmitter. And the membrane here at the very end of the synapse is called the presynaptic, at the end of the neuron, is called the presynaptic membrane. And it's right here at the beginning of the synapse, and it's where the neurotransmitter is released. This area, the gap between the two neurons, is called the synaptic left. And then finally, on the other side is the next neuron, and of course it has a membrane, and that membrane is called the postsynaptic membrane. So it really makes sense. The synapse itself is really made of three things: the presynaptic membrane, the synaptic cleft, and the postsynaptic membrane. And pre means before and post means after, so you can kind of see how that all works. In the next slide, we talk about communication and how it actually works. And what happens here, and it's nicely illustrated in your picture here, an action potential will move down the axon. It will arrive down here at the synaptic terminal, and when it arrives down here, it will cause an influx of calcium ions into the cell. So there are these ion channels that allow calcium in. So this is kind of, because this is a new thing, and another reason why calcium is important in our bodies. So when the calcium comes in to the synaptic, the synaptic terminals down here, it causes these synaptic vesicles to move towards the presynaptic membrane and to actually bind with it. And when it binds or fuses with it, what happens is the neurotransmitter that's stored in these vesicles is released into the synaptic cleft, okay? And then it will diffuse across the synaptic cleft and go over to the other side and bind to receptors on the postsynaptic membrane. And you can actually see that illustrated here nicely, and I've done a blow-up picture of it. And you can see colored in purple, it's a sodium ion channel, and you can see a neurotransmitter colored green is binding to the receptor there, and by binding it causes the sodium channel to open up. Now you can imagine if you start opening up a number of sodium channels, that starts to depolarize the membrane. If you depolarize the membrane to the point where it becomes negative 55 millivolts, you've hit threshold. And now you've created an action potential in this new neuron. Yes? to say, I yeah, so what you're asking is, how does the initial, like let's say something touches you, or you hear something, or any kind of sensory input, how is that sensory input translated into some kind of nervous signal? And what happens is, in our nervous system, there are these, the sensory apparatus are evolved in a particular way. They are really trans, you know, we talked about this idea of transduction, taking a signal that's in one form and translating it into another form. They are really transducers, and they have evolved so that they can take physical information of some kind from the outside world and translate it into a chemical reaction at the cell surface, so you get opening and closing of ion channels, and then that creates the action potential, okay? So it's, and we don't get into that, because if you take a neuroscience class in college, then you'll get into how that works. But we just, because there's too much to cover, what we're just talking about is, once that signal gets started, how does it move from, you know, neuron to neuron? Okay, yeah. Well, if you can imagine, all the different systems in your body are all wired differently, right? So your sight system is wired in its own way, and your sound system is wired in its own way, your touch. So they have their own, like at your house, you've got a telephone line that goes out. You may have cable that goes out, which is, you know, maybe Comcast. So it's all these different cables, and the different companies deal with it. It's the same thing in your body. You have different systems. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they're, you know, cross-talking or something. Okay, what's interesting about this and is that some of these neurotransmitters are excitatory, and so they cause, let's say, the postsynaptic membrane, you know, those ion channels to open up to sodium, and they stimulate the next neuron. But there are some neurotransmitters, nerves that are inhibitory, and they do the exact opposite. Rather than binding and opening up, they close down the sodium channel, and they prevent the movement of ions, and therefore stimulating. So they can be either or. And the interesting thing about this, and this is what I think is so cool about the nervous system, if you think about it, the nervous system is just kind of, it's binary. It's plus or minus. It's very much like a computer. You think about computers, those of you that know anything about computers, the basic code in all computers is ones and zeros, right? It's binary. Either it's on or it's off. And that whole idea is really how our nervous system is designed as well. And so there is this dream someday, which is kind of cool, is that when we develop our computer technology to some sophisticated point in the future, that we could potentially create a computer that has as many connections as our brain, and we could program it, and that entity, that, you know, that computer could have a sense of artificial intelligence, where it's truly artificially intelligent. Because if it's just ones and zeros and connections, maybe that's possible. I don't know if any of you ever saw the movie, anyone seen the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey? Oh, you did! How wild! Well, so it's the ultimate sci-fi movie. So if you want to see a really, and it's not like Star Wars or something like that. It's really intellectual, and it raises really, it really makes you think. And in that movie, there is a computer called HAL, H-A-L, and the computer is really artificially intelligent, and it actually sort of takes on a life of its own in this movie. And this was done back in 1969. But it's this idea that, you know, someday we could potentially create something as intelligent or more intelligent than ourselves, because it's just ones and zeros. It's just, you know, it's kind of wild. So some of you might be interested, like when we get to the brain unit, you might actually want to do your project on artificial intelligence. You know, where are we today? You know, what's the likelihood that in your lifetime we will create HAL or something like HAL, you know. Okay. So one of the things I want to talk about in the next slide is how does this work? Well, it turns out that there's multiple synaptic inputs on every neuron. So here's an example of a cell. You can see a cell body and a bunch of dendrites, and you'll notice there are two types of neurons. There's excitatory neurons, and they're illustrated in green, and there's inhibitory neurons illustrated in red. And so basically, this neuron that you see here has many, many, many neurons connected to it, sending it messages, positive messages, negative messages. And what it has to decide is, well, do I send a signal down my axon? I know I'm making this rather anthropomorphic, so excuse me. And where that happens is down at the axon hillock, which is down at the sort of where the cell body meets the axon. It integrates all this information, and then it makes a decision. Do I send a message down the axon, or do I not? And it all is based on whether it hits threshold, negative 55 millivolts or less, in a more closer to zero, okay? And this is a very simplified version of how it works. Now, if you want to think about how you can sum all these postsynaptic potentials, there's two ways of summing them. You can either sum them temporally or spatially. And what I mean by that, when I say temporally, I mean, and this is kind of, you got to really get this. This is one of the main things you got to understand about the nervous system, is that let's say you are out building something and you hit something with a hammer, and then you hit your hand with a hammer. And whether you hit your hand with a hammer hard or soft, you will get a signal to your brain. And if it's hard, it's really going to hurt. And if it's soft, it's not so much. How does your brain, what's going on in your nervous system to tell the difference between the hard hit and the soft hit? And one of the things you should know about this is that all action potentials are the same. They're always the same. So you've learned about this yesterday. The action potential goes up to maybe about plus 35 millivolts. If you hit your hand with a hammer really hard, your action potentials still go to 0.35 millivolts. So there's no difference there. So the way you tell the difference is how frequently those action potentials come down your neuron and how many other neurons are involved. And that will be the indicator. But it's not, that you get bigger action potentials because you hit yourself with a hammer harder. And so right here, whether you get a message, if you look in my picture, you'll see you always have to hit threshold in order to get an action potential. And in this case, you're getting two graded potentials that don't quite reach threshold. And so, but now you can imagine if those two graded potentials were closer together in time, then what would happen is what you see in the next picture. You see that, the second one happened soon enough after the first that when you added them together, you hit threshold and there's your action potential. So like I said, if they are close enough in time, you'll get an action potential. And in my next slide, you'll see that, went too far. Let's go back. Okay, you'll see that if you've got, let's say, two neurons coming down, touching a cell body fairly close to one another, because you have maybe the same signal, but they're fairly close to one another, then you can add them up and you'll get an action potential as well. So it's either spatially or temporarily summed. Now, you could also get next slide, you could have an inhibitory neuron and an excitatory neuron fairly close to one another, and they would cancel each other out. So you can see in my illustration, in one case, you actually hyperpolarize the membrane, and the other one, you depolarize, and so they kind of cancel each other out. You never hit threshold, so therefore you never get an action potential. So these are different ways. It's fairly simple, actually, how it works. I want to talk about neurotransmitters for a minute, and I want to compare them with hormones, because the College Board loves to have you sort of compare and contrast, particularly in May, when you at the end of the course, they kind of expect you to synthesize things and see big, broad patterns. So I'm going to help you do that right now. We remember that neurotransmitters are chemical messengers that'll bind to a receptor on a cell surface, right? We just showed that. And it's going to cause the opening of an ion channel. And they're all very simple. They're not very complicated. They're like modified amino acids, or very short peptides. Okay. The reason why is because your nerves are sending signals billions of times every second, so you need to have cheap and easy neurotransmitters. You can't, spend a lot of energy making these things. And they travel a very short distance across the synapse, and they must act very fast, less than a second. Hormone, on the other hand, can either bind to a receptor on the cell surface or it can bind to a receptor inside the cell, and it causes a chemical change in the cell, or it causes the translation of a protein. Now, because a hormone takes a longer time to act, can move throughout the circulatory system, they can be modified amino acids, they can be steroids, they can be long peptides, even several hundred amino acids long, no problem. And so there is a contrast here, but they are both ways of communicating. Okay, let's talk about neuropharmacology for a minute. This is using drugs to change brain states. Certain drugs, it turns out, look like neurotransmitters. Therefore, the second neuron, the postsynaptic neuron, can get fooled. A drug-induced hallucination is simply a message that gets transmitted without a neurotransmitter. And serotonin is a very common neurotransmitter in the brain. Your brain is full of serotonin receptors. They're located on dendrites and cell bodies. And, in normal brain processing, the neuron, the presynaptic neuron, will release serotonin and, all is good. But if you take a drug like LSD, mescaline, psilocybin, or something like this, they look like serotonin. And so they're going to fit into those serotonin receptors, and they're going to stimulate them. The problem is they're stimulating them randomly in your brain. So your brain becomes very confused. So what your brain tries to do is somehow organize this random, chaotic stimulation into some kind of organized framework. And that's what we believe hallucinations are, is your brain trying to cope with random stimulation of all these serotonin receptors. Now, this is just, they don't fully understand it, but this is one theory about how it works. Okay, I want to talk about acetylcholine. This is a great story. I think you'll like it. Turns out that acetylcholine is the most common neurotransmitter in both invertebrates and vertebrates, so inside us. And it is actually the exclusive neurotransmitters in stimulating muscle cells to contract. So every one of your nerves that is communicating with the muscle, the neurotransmitter that it's releasing is acetylcholine everywhere in your body. Now, interesting story. Native South Americans discovered that a particular vine illustrated here, if you extract the substance from it and you put it on the tip of arrows, it would cause the prey to die very quickly. And they called this solution curare because it means poison in their language. Now, what they didn't know this, but we know this now. Curare actually works by binding to the acetylcholine receptors on the muscles. Very interesting. So what they do is they block the receptors from being stimulated by acetylcholine, and therefore muscles can't contract. And the muscles that are really important are the muscles that cause you to breathe. And these animals stop breathing. Any vertebrate will stop breathing. And so if you look at my illustration here, I've got a picture, and you'll notice that there is a sodium channel, and normally the green sort of circles that are coming out, that's the neurotransmitter acetylcholine. But if an organism gets this red one, which is curare, it'll bind to these ion channel receptors. It'll keep the sodium channels closed, and then the acetylcholine can't bind to it and open it up and cause a nervous signal to go through the muscle and cause the muscle to contract. So that's how they die. Now, here's an interesting thing. Neurotransmitters like acetylcholine absolutely have to be broken down after they bind to their receptors on the postsynaptic neuron, because you need to prevent the postsynaptic neuron from being overstimulated, right? This is done via enzymes, and the important enzyme here is called acetylcholinesterase. Can you all say that for me? Very good. The byproducts of the breakdown are reabsorbed into the presynaptic membrane, and they're used to reconstruct acetylcholine. That's all good. Now, what about nerve gas? Turns out that nerve gases like sarin and VX are acetylcholinesterase inhibitors, and they block the action of acetylcholinesterase. Acetylcholine cannot be broken down. Acetylcholine builds up at the synapse. Acetylcholine continues to act. And the symptoms are muscle paralysis, and breathing will stop. This is how nerve gases work, and there's an animation of this I've got listed here. One other thing, other nasty things. Many animals use neurotoxin as defensive or offensive weapons, and they act on the synapse in some way. There's a great website if you want to look at them all. Teratotoxin in zombies. There's a book called The Serpent and the Rainbow, and you can learn how to make a zombie. And this guy, Wade Davis, was a graduate student at Harvard studying ethnobotany, and that's like using drugs extracted from plants by native cultures to do something. And what he went and he sort of infiltrated the zombie, you know, voodoo deal in Haiti. He found out that they were using what's called teratotoxin. And what teratotoxin is, it's a very nasty chemical that will kill you, essentially. And they've been giving it to people in very small doses, which makes their breathing go very, very, you know, you can barely notice it, and they look like they're dead. And that's the whole zombie ritual. Interesting thing is, teratotoxin is also found in these puffer fish, and it's known, like Japanese, very exclusive food that you can eat is food from this puffer fish. And they have to have special chefs who will do it just right. And so when you go to the restaurant and eat this fish, this sushi, you get a slight tingling in your mouth because of this toxin, this neurotoxin, but it won't kill you. Now wait. And I'm just going to warn you, there is an organism in California that has teratotoxin, and it warns you that it's dangerous, and it's out now during the winter time, walking around in the mountains here. Does anyone know what it is? No. It's called the California newt. Have you ever seen one? And if you look at the belly of the newt, what do you see? It's very bright orange red, and that's warning you. I got teratotoxin, don't mess with me.